Hello and welcome everyone to this special Labour Party conference edition of the Better Places podcast here in Liverpool. I'm Yannis Sofokleous from Consilio and I'm joined by my colleague and co-host for the day, Sid O'Dwyer.
Hello everyone and welcome. My name is Sid O'Dwyer. It was great to be here in Liverpool, especially for the Labour Party conference where Labour's setting its mission for government. That's one built around fairness, growth and of course getting Britain building again. Hi everyone and welcome back to the Better Places podcast. My name is Sid O'Dwyer and today myself and Yanni are interviewing a great panel on a discussion to make London fun again. We're here in Liverpool. Labour's setting out its new mission for government, one that features both growth, fairness and of course getting Britain building again. And that makes today's theme, Make London Fun Again, a timely one. We're talking about how our public spaces, high streets and London's experience economy can drive growth, investment and community life. We've got four fantastic guests, Councillor Jeff Barraclough, who is a cabinet member for planning and economic development at Westminster City Council. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you.
We also have Councillor Portia Mangwanje, cabinet member for Leisure Parks and Young People at Southwark Council. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And accompanying them are Antonia Strafford, Head of Public Affairs at the Heart of London, Heart of London Business Alliance. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And of course, Graham Craig, Director and Chief Executive of Places for London. Welcome.
It's a pleasure.
Before we dive into London specifically, it'd be remiss of me to not ask how we all think the mood at conference is going. It's already a big couple of days. We have Steve Reid pledging to build, baby build, three new towns, one of which, actually 12 new town priorities, one of which are coming forward in my native Enfield, signalling a speeding up of planning and a clear focus on housing and growth. So in a sentence or two, guys, what stood out to you so far in the last few days and what do you feel the mood's like?
Well, I think the mood's pretty good because there's lots of interesting announcements. We're moving things in the right direction. And I just wish everyone would get a little bit less obsessed about an election that will happen in 2029 and more obsessed about what we can do in the 12 months ahead.
Absolutely.
There's investment in a whole variety of different sectors, housing, the industrial strategy. We're sorting out renters' rights, we're sorting out employment rights. It's what you expect a Labour government to do. So generally, yeah, just everyone relax.
I think I've been very optimistic. I'm obviously seeing the news for the last couple of weeks. It's been a bit daunting, but coming here and speaking to everybody, going to the fringes, we're talking about the things that we're doing in our communities. I mean, the investment that we're making with young people has been absolutely amazing. I think the last 2 weeks we've been talking about youth opportunities and the work and investing in youth clubs and investing in our young people in our community. So I'm happy to hear it more than I have in the last couple of weeks.
Mm. Antonia, Graham?
Yeah, I just echo those comments. I think there's a really positive vibe, as the kids say, at the conference. And I've just been listening to Rachel Reeves' speech just a couple of hours ago. I think it was great. She reiterated the government's plans for housing planning, which is all positive. But of course, I am going to bring this up. There was only one mention of London and the wider South East. And I think a lot of her speech did focus on support and investment outside of London, and also hinted that the big sort of thing that we've all been waiting for, the sort of harsh global headwinds ahead of the budget. So no hint really about what she's going to do, but yeah, so interesting.
I'm sure we'll dive in, especially when Yanni takes over the hot chair here. But Graham?
The mood music's all positive, I think. Lots of talk about growth, lots of talk about housing. Great to hear the news about the new towns and fantastic. Mm. I think that two of those new towns is based in London.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, the context here is the single most helpful thing. A government that's talking about what it is that matters. And, you know, the number of times I've seen hats with build, baby build on them.
I seem to have lost mine, actually. I think I left it in someone's bag, but
the single most helpful thing for me is knowing that I can sit opposite people who might be expressing some qualms about individual schemes that we're keen to bring forward. And I've then got the chance to say to them, how does what you're saying chime with a very clear message from the government of Build, Baby, Build?
And yeah, now I'm Yanis. I'm also taking the hot seat now alongside my colleague Sidhu. These are very, really interesting reflections of the conference so far. And I think they set up us perfectly for the theme of today's episode, which is how to make London fun again. Obviously, some argue that London is already fun and it still is being fun. It's vibrant, it's global, it's buzzing. But others argue that affordability challenges, viability challenges, rising costs, and policy headwinds are really clouding this story. Jeff, let me start off this question with you. How do you see this from a Westminster perspective?
Well, I think London is still fun. I think it's a lot more fun than it was when I was 30 years younger. There's a huge amount going on, but what we define as fun, what young people define as fun, I think maybe has changed. It's much less focused around drinking and much more focused around experience and differentiation and things you can tell your friends about.
Yeah.
And novelty. So look, in the West End, we have 100 commercial galleries, 53 music venues, 39 theatres, 4 casinos, 11 dance venues and 3 world-leading art galleries. If you can't find anything to do, I think you need to look a bit harder. And people complain they have to go home early. Can I tell you, we have 417 venues with a licence after 2 a.m. with a capacity of 158,000 people. Again, if you can't find something to do, it may be those venues don't offer what the modern consumer is looking for. Maybe they play the wrong kind of music and maybe they're more expensive. But that's not something the local authority can get involved with. We don't decide what kind of music people play or how much they charge for a pint of beer. So I think there's plenty of activity going on, but it's it is changing.
No, that's true. And I think, Antonia, let me come to you next on this one. From a Heart of London perspective, I know Jeff mentioned the West End. How do you see it from a business perspective in terms of the West End, of the confidence, of its competitiveness in comparison to other cultural districts in the world?
Well, Jeff just stolen all my statistics that I was going to read out.
I probably got them from you.
I'm desperately looking at my list, thinking if I can add to that. But what I would say, absolutely, London is... Listen, we're all, you know, it's a fun, fantastic, global, iconic city, amazing heritage, world-class arts, nightlife, food, fashion, music festivals, a huge diversity and a reputation for creative and innovation. And I've heard this a lot in the last couple of days. You know, we have 17 universities in London ranked in the top 10 globally. And just to sort of drill down a little bit from my sort of tourism background, the UK is a top 10 tourism destination and half of all international visitors come to London and recently voted number one TripAdvisor Traveller's Choice Award. So clearly we've got a huge amount going for the city. But yeah, I am going to come on to some of those headwinds. And I've written down here, fun needs foundation to be fixed for it to flourish. I was quite proud of that alliteration. And the experience economy, which I know we'll come on to talk about, it almost hasn't sort of evolved with a policy framework. And we don't want to stifle the very industries that make London unique. I mean, the experience economy has a huge growth potential. The UK valued at $300 billion. Globally forecast to reach 12.8 trillion by 2028. So we need to really capitalize on that. But as I said, the policy framework, we don't think is sort of keeping up with that. So we're looking, obviously, high operating costs of businesses, well promoted. The changes to NI, the business rates, minimum wage. I heard a stat the other day that beer is taxed 3 times before it crosses the bar. Crime and safety, again, this is not going to be a new topic for anyone around this table. People want to feel safe when out and about. And I think the Met Police are very, very open about that fact that whilst levels of violent crime have decreased, levels of petty crime, such as shop theft and mobile phone theft and incidents of antisocial behaviour, unfortunately, have increased. We could talk about planning and licensing, Jess' favourite area. And we listen to our members. They tell us there are inconsistencies between the two frameworks. Licensing policy can be rigid and restrictive. We know that obviously central government and Westminster are looking at that at the moment, and transport as well. Thursday night now is the new Friday night. But again, we want to see, and again, I know there's a lot of complexities with this. We want to see the night tube extended to Thursday, even if only by an hour, just to keep up with that post-pandemic reform. So changes in consumer habits. So I probably talked too much there.
No. That's very interesting. And Portia, coming to you now, obviously there is life outside Westminster as well. I mean, Southwark is one of the youngest boroughs in London. Do you think that young people in your borough feel that London is as fun and accessible as it should be? And yeah, what can be done in order to make it even funner?
Honestly, the quick answer is no. We don't think it's as fun. And I say we, I'm a young adult now. I'm not a young person anymore, sadly. But it's not as fun as it should be, one, because none of us have any money to enjoy. It's bleak for us at the moment. And that's why, so with my experience as the cabinet member for leisure and culture, so culture and festivals are in my brief. And the ideas that we're trying, well, the experiences we're trying to create, we're talking about the experience economy. We need things to be around us. And that gets very difficult when we aren't able to hold festivals because people are basically saying, oh, it's too noisy and we don't want it in our backyard. And the festivals have to adhere to 34 people over 100 or basically 50,000 people that are coming throughout the year doing that come to our major events. So it gets, for me, it gets very difficult when I'm making decisions because, yes, absolutely, we have to make certain restrictions and make sure that the noise is at national policy level. But again, being at national policy level, they're not. It's still very loud for the people that are surrounding those areas. It's also very loud when you include weather factors. So if it's windy, it's going to travel and the people in the estates are going to suffer for it. And yes, we do have to make certain concessions. But I think that has now, we've seen the whole situation with Brockwell Park. And we've seen the outcry that young people had when they basically couldn't, they thought that their experience was going to get taken away from them. We're basically scared that everything just keeps getting taken away from us and we're not having a say in how we experience London. And yeah, it's the money, it's people listening to just a few voices opposed to the larger voices. And we feel like our voices are not being heard. And it's just the rules. We don't understand what is going to make everybody happy. And we can't make everyone happy. So what's the balance? What balance do we basically strike in that whole situation?
Well, if I could come in there, Portia, because we recognised as an incoming administration, that was a problem that we had in Westminster. Mm-hmm. We began this thing called Westminster After Dark, which is a big engagement exercise to try and land a consensus between the residents, the visitors, the businesses, the police about, could we get to a consensus about what people felt was reasonable? No one was going to get everything they wanted. But in the West End, there's been a huge increase in the number of restaurants with Class E. A lot of shops become restaurants. Streets that closed at 5, 6 o'clock in the evening now close at 11 midnight, way noisier. Huge amount more activity. And we ran a stakeholder assembly, and there's quite a lot of coming together actually about what people felt was fair and reasonable. And we're about to launch a set of policies, including a full review of licensing, but also alongside planning and work with the police to try and take that forward. So I think you have to try to get to a consensus while recognizing that not everyone's going to get everything that they want. But what you can't do, I think, as you were saying, Portia, you can't let one small group of people hold everybody else to ransom while recognising that the small group of people might actually have a point.
Yeah, and I will say, sorry, before we move on to the next question, there's a difference because West End, there's not a lot of residential like areas in where most of the fun is happening, and that's what we struggle with. So if you're in the middle of Peckham Rye Park, literally it's a full residential area, young people, there's a school right next to it. So we have to factor in all of those things when we're doing festivals. And yeah, it gets very, very difficult. So I understand how you guys are dealing with it, but it's, yeah, with us, it's a very, very difficult situation.
Isn't
tracking balance.
A case though of these experiences are also for the residents living in the area, so it shouldn't be against them. It's not something that they should feel imposing to them. I think even if it's a residential area, I think there is an element of this can be for the community that actually lives there, and not something that they should be by default against it.
I mean, yeah, go. And I was going to say, we make about up to £500,000 the council makes for our major events. 31,000 of that goes back into replenishing our parks and making sure that they are the standard that they were left in. We charge 12.5% of an environmental impact fee from the organization so that we can put that back into our park. So we're constantly putting the money back into the spaces that we're using. And I think it's also important to note, when people are complaining about these events taking up all of our open spaces, it's literally about 2 weeks at most out of the entire year. And when we're talking about the use of our parks, festivals are a use of our parks. That is how young people want to use those spaces. In the winter, we're stuck in our rooms or in our university halls or essentially like not able to do the things that we want to do. So when it comes to the summer, that is how we use it. So we understand that there is other uses of parks where, you know, you've got to make sure that the children are getting taken into account and you've got to walk your dog and you've got to do all of those things. But you can do that every other day. It's the 2 weeks in the year that we want to use it in that way. So I think we need to expand the idea of how our open spaces are being used. For example, a public square, having an open mic night on a public square is also a use of that space, and you're bringing other communities into that space, and they're having a different way of expressing it. So I think we need to be a little bit open-minded with the uses of our open spaces.
No, I agree. And I think it's more about how do you communicate this and make the community feel a part of this process. Now, Andrea, let's come to you as well. Obviously, you've been leading on regeneration and placemaking projects as part of Places for London. And do you think that London still has this spark in its public realm, or is it harder to deliver these kind of experiences through placemaking?
Oh, fundamentally, London's got its challenges, but for me, it's still the best city in the world. There is nowhere else I would rather be. I'm in an enormously privileged position, I think we all are, to work in London at this time. And I think London has its critics. Most of those critics don't live in London. They don't understand the city. For me, fundamentally, the fact that anything you could want to eat, drink, experience, see is here, almost uniquely more than anywhere on the planet. And you either embrace and love the fact that London is a diverse, inclusive world city, or you look to fight against it. And, you know, for me, like I say, there is nowhere else I would rather be. I am clearly keen that within Places for London, we do everything that we can to address those headwinds, those challenges, particularly, of course, the affordable housing crisis. But yeah, it's a brilliant city. We've got 1,500 amazing tenants across our estate, 95% of whom are small businesses. And you go to things like the Arches, and every one of the people in those Arches has their life story. They're doing something that matters deeply to them. So I feel enormously proud of the customers, the tenants who we've got. More than that, I feel proud to live and work in London.
Well, that's definitely the case. And I think this is what is unique about London that everyone can recognize. And on that point, how do we feel about the role of mood music? Do we think we underestimate the role of confidence in from a landowner's perspective, a business perspective, and a delivery perspective in shaping whether London can deliver these fun experiences?
So, well, I think mood music is deeply, deeply important. It's almost the single most important thing that a government at a local London and national level can do. Professor Greg Clark, he talks about London being a negotiated city, and I think that's absolutely true. But the messages about what it is that London stands for, what it is that the UK needs, London's position, both in the southeast and in the UK around the world, the more that's clearer, it helps in the detailed negotiation that does go on. I've lived in London for just over 20 years. I think London has, there are challenges, yes, I accept that, but I think London has improved immeasurably over that time. Within Places for London, we've got huge amounts of investment going on across the capital. What I would say about that investment is every time we do a development, it's controversial. I cannot think of one example where once something is built, anytime anyone has said, no, I think you should take it back. You might have built at Blackhorse Road 350 homes, 50% affordable. There is no one who goes to that site now who says, no, I think you should get rid of all those homes. Go back to that bleak car park with 250 spaces at night. It's just time and again, we put the investment in up to including something of the scale of the Elizabeth Line. And it demonstrates enormous impact, enormous benefits across the city. But somehow we need to continue to have to make that case again and again and again. And I think the more that within London we can talk with one voice, that it's not London against the rest of the UK, it's not a zero-sum game. London is a brilliant city, but like anywhere, it needs investment. And, you know, I am resolutely positive about this city.
Well, and it's great to hear you say that. And we need confidence, and to support confidence, and out of confidence brings investment. And there's plenty coming in. But I am concerned about London being caught in the crosshairs of the global culture wars, and there being people who make it their life's work to talk down London. Many of them may be based in St. Petersburg, working for the Russians or whatever, but it's having an impact. So the first thing you have to do when you meet people from around the world is say, the stuff you're seeing on your Twitter feed, that's not how it's like. You can walk down the street in London and it's fine. Everyone's getting on with their lives and having fun and shopping and going to work. So I think we need to call out that anti-London rhetoric wherever it is, because it is designed to undermine our city.
No, definitely. And I think, Antonia, I think that's where the work from business improvement districts and yourselves as the heart of London business line do in terms of how you show to the outside world on what does London mean, and essentially in the way that London is being marketed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't look after this area at Holbor, but we do a huge amount of sort of events and activations to draw visitors into the area. Lots of sort of innovative stuff. Our statues in the square trail. It just highlights the amazing film industry that we have in the country. We have our Art After Dark activation, showcasing galleries across the West End. So yeah,
you'll all see that I've morphed into back into myself. We'll stick with you, on Antonia. I wonder from of London and the work that you do with the BID, whilst we move now into a kind of policy context, and both locally and nationally, what levers do you think or would give the West End and the experience economy a big boost?
Are we talking nationally, regionally, locally, anything?
Your pick.
I think from a national perspective, I mean, just as is, so we sort of in the middle of launching a campaign around business rate reform. It's one of those subjects that probably everybody sort of groans when I bring it up, but it is
the perennial gripe of many.
Yeah, absolutely. But just to sort of give you an example of that, they should remain nameless, but we've got a fantastic sort of experience economy business in our patch of the West End. With the changes to the multipliers coming in next April, their tax bill as a whole is going to go up to £2 million. And this is a business that can't, you know, because of that change, they're looking to potentially look overseas for expansion. And so I think, yeah, business rate reform, we want to, this is not a wildly new idea, but we want to see more of a level of the playing field between the online world and the high street. It shouldn't be big business versus small business. It should be high street versus online, with some exemptions. So that's something I would like to see reform. Crime and safety, again, perception of crime and safety, we've already talked about that. And we were really pleased to see the mayor commit to 80 new posts in the West End earlier in the summer. Really happy with that, but we can't be complacent. We have the unfortunate accolade of Leicester Square being one of the crime hotspots in London. So crime and safety needs to, can't rest our laurels with that. again, this is not a new tax-free shopping, or is we would love to see that reinstated. And I think the latest research shows that if it was to be reinstated, it would generate over $5 billion for the UK economy. And I don't think that should be ignored. And just last as well, but certainly not least, is just arts and culture provision in the West End is at the heart of it. And during the pandemic, I hear our chief exec always talks about restaurants and hotels would call her up and say, when are the theatres coming back? So it's absolutely the cornerstone of the West End. So we want to see that ongoing investment in our arts and culture provision, which is at the heart of everything we do.
Mm. And indeed, for the two politicians, and while I'm not going to ask you to preempt the budget, I'm sure the conversation around tax, whether it's tax-free shopping or business rate reform, will also be matched with the mission that this government has to fix parts of our public realm. I wonder, from both of your perspectives, is there anything that you agree with, and what more would you like to see brought about, either in your respective boroughs or more nationally, to generate a real sense or more vibrancy around our nighttime economy and parks and leisure?
So we would very much endorse Holber's ideas around business rate reform. They are a bit complicated, but please download the paper and have a read. It is complicated, but yes, it's the right way to go. And we would very much like to see tax-free shopping reinstated. It was dumb Rishi Sunak axed it in the first place. Never made any sense to axe it. If you are a Londoner and you're getting married, go to Paris, buy a ring, get the VAT back, and that'll pay for your trip to Paris and a couple of nights in a hotel. Isn't it a shame that Parisians getting married won't come to London and do the same thing? It's mad. So very much would support that. If I could wave a magic wand, sorting out policing in the West End, absolutely. The 80 new cops is terrific. There's an 18-18-18-person squad the council's putting together, half police, half city inspectors to allocate to hotspots. And we've improved the CCTV coverage enormously, which will help if the police access the CCTV and use it to defeat crime. And if I could add one thing on my list for the police, when the Blue Note Jazz Cafe came to the licensing committee to get a late light license for their new premises on St. Martin's Lane, the mayor sent his 24/7 team to argue for a late license, and the police sent a barrister to argue against a license. So,
which isn't uncommon across London.
I know. So, it's really difficult for councillors sat on licensing committees when the police turn up with a barrister and say, you should refuse this. Obviously, we don't always follow the advice from the police, but that would be one thing, wave a magic wand, I would resolve.
For me, it would be planning policy. So, we need to work with developers to help us build our culture in our boroughs, because it's very difficult. We don't have, I mean, we know all the pressures that we're having on the HRA. We know the pressures that we're going to be having because of the fair funding review on our budgets in 2026 and beyond. So I think that we need the help of developers to help us build our public realm. And we're doing that. We're trying to do our best with that with our new town centre in Canada Water. So,
which I visited last week. Absolutely stunning, by the way. The work that Southwark's done with British Land. Sorry to cut across you.
Yeah. No, so we've done that with our... so we've been able to have a new gym. So we opened up Canada Water Leisure Centre.
150 strengths training stations for anyone interested.
Yep, free from Friday to Sunday. So we're able to give that as a local authority because British Land was able to help us build that. But we have this old, I don't know if anyone knows about it, print work. So it's like a club space, event space. So we would very much, as a council and as residents, love to keep that space, but we need to be working with the landowners to make sure that they're able to bring that. So for me, putting something into planning policy that makes sure wherever we're going to be building our new cities, we're going to be building our new places, that galleries are there, community spaces where people can... do cultural events, making sure that we're able to, you know, open new clubs, open new, new art spaces, celebrating the culture. We need that help because we're going to be having a very hard time doing that with our budgets at the moment.
That's quite a positive signal that Portia and Jeff has sent there, Graham. I wonder, from a regeneration and placemaking perspective, particularly around stations, what policy levers would you like to see pulled to make your job perhaps that bit easier?
I guess the first thing to say as a statement of the obvious is that London isn't one homogeneous place. It's a whole variety of villages and towns and cities. And I think government recognising that London has amazingly bright lights, but also some of the most challenging, most deprived parts of the country, not dealing with London as a single place. I think ultimately London was built on the back of the transport network. And of course, I'm going to say that that relationship between transport and development, transport unlocking development and development funding the transport network, it's 100 years since Metroland. But again, that just feels like it's a lesson that we need to continue to have to learn. I've spoken already about government's importance in terms of mood music. The other thing I would say is the convening power of government, government bringing people together. We've got a strategic relationship with Network Rail, now under the badge of Platform 4, as their mechanism to bring forward development growth on Network Rail land across London. So across the city, we're combining our land interests with Network Rail. It would be great to see other public bodies bringing their land forward. I think there's huge benefits that can come in terms of housing, of course, affordable housing, workspace, affordable workspace, but also the culture, the entertainment, the public space. I think forcing us all to think about every square foot that we own and not expecting public bodies to solve those problems by themselves, but the convening power of government coming together to say, how can we work together? I think doing that at scale is, you know, there is for me enormous potential for us to continue to take this city forward, particularly, of course, the land that's around stations, but above all, really, it's the land that's in London's town centres on those high streets, thinking about how we can unlock the investment that undoubtedly wants to be made if we can make it as easy as possible for individuals across the UK or beyond to make the investment in this great city.
I mean, it was reported that in May, fewer than, I think it was 25 new build properties had been sold, and then about 19 or so private properties had changed hands then. So there is a real affordability crisis in the city, particularly around housing. And I'll come to the politicians, but also open up to the panel. What levers do you realistically have? And I know you touched on working with developers more closely, Portia, to make London more attractive to particularly younger families that are leaving the city in droves and are really struggling to make a life for themselves other than for those that are already there. Big question, but I wonder.
I mean, to answer that simply, it's just convenience. Having a school nearby you, having a fantastic playground near you, if we're talking about young families, having affordable spaces that you can go to, so cafes, shopping centres, and you guys were just talking about making sure that we have a balance between high streets and online shopping. I think the problem that we have in like Southwark and Lambeth and Lewisham, on our high streets, we don't have big businesses. So that's the reason why we have to rely on the online shopping, because again, traveling to the West End, which we used to do back in the day quite a lot and we don't do anymore because of COVID, and now we found out the convenience of online stores. It would be great to see like a H&M on Woolworth Road. So having businesses like that that are close to you that you're able to go to, I think will attract people to come to those spaces. So yeah, I think it's the convenience of everything. Education and again, safety. Making sure that our children are able to go from point A to point B in a very safe manner. So, yeah, I think that's what we could do.
I mean, Graham made a really good point around the convening power of local authorities and public bodies to really bring a lot of those entities to the table, particularly if they feel like it's worth setting up shop. Of course, Westminster is home to lots of major brands that have found themselves on really popular high streets, or the nation's high street, Oxford Street. What say you, Jeff? How do we make the city more attractive to younger families?
Well, it's a very good question, because we are seeing fewer and fewer children in central London. And as a result, we're finding schools are getting smaller and smaller and often having to close. And I think that's a shame. I think central London should be for everybody. It's a great place to live, should be a great place to raise a family too. We don't really know why. We've all got theories, but I challenged Tony Travis on this and he didn't know. And I said, why don't you put some research students on it? And I've asked our economist at City Hall to take a look to advise our new city plan, which we're kicking off the work on right now, because I'd like our city plan to have an objective to get more children in Westminster. And I don't think it's about building more three-bedroom flats, because we have as many three-bedroom flats now as we had 10 years ago. It's just we've got fewer children. So we need to know why they've gone, why parents have moved out, why people aren't having children maybe now. So there is an affordability crisis across the board. There is clearly now a affordability crisis from property developers too, because we are seeing very few applications for new residential buildings in central London. Demand for commercial is much better because the rent per square metre of commercial property is going up and up and up, particularly for high quality new space. So you can see a business case to build an office block. What there doesn't seem to be is a business case to build a new residential block, unless you're building it on public land with public money. And as a council, we are doing that. We've got two big regeneration sites that are going, but we've kind of maxed out our ability to develop at speed. That's kind of, our pipeline is roughly what it is. And the price of building anything, my goodness. I mean, it costs us £800,000 or £900,000 to build a new two-bedroom council flat. So you can see why the affordability crisis is there. So the last two workshops I've been in today, or meetings with the industry, have been, what can we do? What levers can we pull to try to make it a little bit cheaper to build residential property in central London? What can we do to take a bit of the bureaucracy out of it and speed things up and at least try and de-risk the investment? Because we're all aware that the capital behind a lot of these schemes comes from Europe or around the world. And if investments in London look like, it might take an extra year because of the building safety regulator, people behind them might go, we'll put the money in Madrid or Amsterdam instead. So it's a recognition, I think, now in government, regional government, national government, that this needs to be addressed. And maybe those hats, build, baby, build, are an indicator of the penny dropping.
I think it's an astonishing stat from the land registry of so few coming forward. And indeed, the point around the affordability crisis for developers is one that's not often spoken about. The cost of borrowing is going through the roof. Viability is no longer just a buzzword that you hear at planning. It's something that often many of my clients, I'm sure, with Yanni, come forward. Just before we bring you in, Portia, over to Graham and to Antonia, from both of your perspectives, whether it's the experience economy or the public realm and the confidence that builders need for investment, how are we linking housing delivery to those challenges, and how can we make tangible community benefits like parks, youth spaces and affordable transport make London more attractive?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, from my point of view, it is important that we remember at all times it's about building communities. It's about giving people a roof over the head, giving them a front door key. It's changing someone's life chances. It's building communities that are successful with the amenities, including the public space, that makes a difference. It's not a numbers game. Yes, the numbers are important, but it's fundamentally about building places that work rather than completing the rows on a spreadsheet. And I think, for me, we've got fantastic schemes that were desperate to come forward. We have had issues, as indeed have others, with the building safety regulator, meaning it's taking much, much longer than we want to bring sites forward. I am confident that under the leadership of Andy Rowe, the building safety regulator understands what needs to be done. Again, I'm hearing only positive things in terms of this week about the changes that are going to be made. There isn't only one issue, there isn't just one solution but I remain steadfastly confident. I know what it is that we're working on. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of homes that we are keen to bring forward. I can see the route for that happening. Increasingly, again, that's on the back of the relationships that we've got with the boroughs across London, with Network Rail and other public authorities. I think the industry has been set very high standards. There's a whole number of things that are in the way in terms of what needs to be done. But I think, you know, under the clear vision of Build Baby Build, I am confident that we're going to see numbers increasingly in the months ahead that are transformed from where we have been.
Mm. Antonio, there's lots of positive signals coming out, but how do we make sure that those elements of community aren't just nice to haves, but can really boost the attractiveness? And we'll bring Portia before I stop with Yanni.
Of course. I mean, I think it's, again, sort of goes without saying that a rich cultural and leisure offer is just not a nice to have. It serves a number of very hard economic principles. So London makes London more appealing to skilled workers, a massive magnet for entrepreneurs, for investment. I think when you look after the public realm, you have high quality streets, squares, green spaces. It shows that the city has confidence in itself, that's investing in itself. You know, a diversified economy with strong cultural and experiential dimensions is less vulnerable to shocks as well, giving investors confidence in returns, and a strong visitor economy as well, so economically dynamic for investors and reinforces London's global identity. So all these things together are not just a sort of a luxury or a nice to have. They make hard economic sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going to speak to the point about why a lot of people aren't living in Westminster, why we don't have a lot of children in that area. And it's partly because of green spaces and also partly because of the experiences that people have had outside of the UK. So you can see in places like America, in places like in like south of France or like Geneva, their houses are much bigger. So you've got bigger living rooms, you've got a place where you can have a garden, you've got a place where the air quality is better, there's cleaner air, the streets, the people are cycling, so you're much more fitter. People are moving outside of London, not just because of the affordability aspect of it, but because they just want more space and they want more space to breathe and they want to use their money. They want to use their money well, and the best way to use that is to buy a bigger house as opposed to staying in a 3-bedroom flat where there isn't a green space and the park is like, you have to take a bus to go to the park and to the playground. So I think that's the reason why we're actually, even in Southwark, we're losing that as well. So, and people are moving outside of London for that.
So would you say there's any way of getting them back or getting younger people today to have children stay?
Well, getting younger people to have children or...
Well, that'd be a start.
That would be a start. And it speaks to your point about experiences. We need to actually know how important it is to have things like festivals, having longer opening times for bars, having cheaper drinks, having cheaper food, because that is where people go to meet the loves of their lives. That is where people to go make friends. That's where people go to network and find job opportunities. When we're not investing in these spaces and we're not investing and don't actually understand how important it is to have these experiences, that is the reason why we're having these problems. So we are not having any children because we're not having any experiences. We're not meeting people. We're staying more online than anything and losing that social aspect of what it means to be a human. So if you want to get people to start falling in love again, let's have more festivals and let's have longer hours in our clubs. So.
Can I just jump in on one point? When I had younger children, we moved out of London for all the reasons you talk about. Now they're in their early 20s and teenagers, they are desperate to be in London. Absolutely, the festivals, the events, the bars, they don't want to be stuck out on the countryside. So, there you go. They come back eventually.
They come, yeah.
It is indeed a mixed picture. And actually, I hadn't thought of it that way, unfortunately. So I think that's certainly something to reflect on.
And yeah, and as we're now wrapping this up, I'm back to the microphone to end it on a more positive note. So it's a question for all of you, really, following this very interesting discussion. Fast forward 10 years, and what does a fun, fair, and affordable London look like for you? Starting from you, Brea.
Well, for what it's worth, I'm resolutely optimistic about London. London is, and I think will remain, the preeminent world city. I would hope that we can get through the current noise and get a recognition about all the, the fact that the diversity, the inclusion, the vibrancy of London is something of which we should be proud. I hope that we can get to a point where London is seen as being, a core element, the engine for growth in the UK. It's not something that somehow in some zero-sum game, it's seen as being it's London against the rest of the UK. Ultimately, investment in London benefits the whole of the country. I think, again, I'm aware of what we are doing. I'm aware of what it is that is planned. I am hugely, hugely excited about what's coming down the tracks. London's got a hell of a lot better in the 20 years in which I've lived here. I am confident that building communities that reflect the diversity of London's villages and towns and cities, that yes, have the public space, the cultural space, the communities that's more than just homes. I am confident that London will be a better place in the future. And I think that can only be achieved by us working together ever more closely.
No, definitely. And I think this is the message that needs to be clearer, that a better London can make the whole country better and can support growth in the wider country, essentially. And Antonia, from your perspective, from a Heart of London perspective, how do you view this fun, fair and affordable London from a more West End approach?
So what I suppose our vision, we'd like to see, people don't need a high income to enjoy culture, live securely, participate fully. And actually one policy lever I haven't talked about, and I'm going to get shot if I don't mention it now, is that obviously all the ideas we talked about today are fantastic. They do have to be supported by that policy framework. And one idea we have to support a fun, fair and affordable London is to see the international centre designation that currently exists in the West End, but we want to see that evolved. So it includes, Jeff's going to kill me now for saying this, the West End in its entirety. We disagree a little bit on that. But to have policies very tailored to the West End to support the iconic, fun, destination that it is. So I think, the policy framework needs to change, and if we start off with that designation, that recognition, and then build upon that.
No, exactly. And Jeff Porcia, from your perspective, as obviously you are in government in your local council, so how do you view this vision for London, essentially, and your areas?
Well, going back to one of my earlier points, one of the reasons why the global right is so angry about London is because we are a hugely diverse and hugely successful city where people come from all over the world. They live their lives, they get educated, they fall in love, they make friends, they have children, they have careers, and they make money, and they pay a huge amount of tax that funds lots of things all over the UK. So we don't want to lose that. I don't think we will lose that, because being a Londoner is something a little bit special, and we're all Londoners. It doesn't matter where you began and where you end up. We end up here, we're Londoners, and it remains the best city in the world.
I absolutely agree. We've spoken a lot about policy and making sure where the government is convening bodies and the local government is convening bodies. We can't create policy without people. I have always tried my best to tell our local communities, our young people, our children, and even our older senior citizens to come to our consultations. And I think the best way that we can fulfill our vision is to get these people in the rooms. And we need to emphasize how important it is for people between the ages of 25 to 40, actually, to get into these rooms and advocate for themselves. So an example of it is when we're doing our festivals, you have to have a public consultation and you have to have the in-person consultation. You only ever see friends of there. You only ever see the people that live around the square mile of where that specific park is. And what I'm trying to push our communities to do, especially our diverse communities, they need to get into those rooms and answer the questions that are being asked about what does this space mean to you? Why are we having this festival in the first place? What is it going to give to our local community? How is it going to contribute to our green spaces? Where is the money going? And how are we going to contribute from that? And also talking about ticket prices, talking about what are the things, what are the major events going to do for us in terms of our communities? Can you have a community event so that people that can't afford to come to that, can you make something that is free for the rest of the people? So we need to get people into these rooms as much as we need to create the policy, but it can't be created without them. So we need to make sure that they are telling us exactly how that needs to be done.
I agree. I think it's exactly that. We want young people to be interested. We want young people to be involved and shape their futures. And yeah, on the point, Jeff, you also mentioned, I mean, I moved in this country 11 years ago as a young student, and I think London has a great pool, and this diversity is something that should be celebrated. And I don't think we should forget how great mm-hmm. London is just mm-hmm. because there is a narrative at the moment mm-hmm. that is trying to push it the other way. And yeah, before we wrap up, if there was a message from this panel for everyone, government, developers, landowners, what would that be? Starting from you, Portia and Jeff.
My point just goes back to planning. We need to make sure that our partners are helping us deliver for our residents. So that would be my outcry. We all need to work together to build stronger, fairer and funner communities.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue with that.
Thank you. Graham?
Above all, my message, building homes, building communities is an investment. See it as an investment. See it as fundamentally delivering the future of London that's so critical to the future of the rest of the UK.
And Antonia?
I'd say my main sort of last message, really, like the West End, it remains competitive because businesses and cultural institutions work hand in hand to deliver experiences, animate public spaces and sustain London's global reputation.
Mm. No, exactly. And I think that sums up the conversation really nicely in the sense that this is what we want from London, to celebrate its diversity, at the same time invest together in placemaking and really making it an exciting place for people who live here now, but also for the future generations. I would really like to thank you now from myself and my colleague Sidhu for joining us here today. It has been a great conversation. Really looking forward to actually listening to the episode, and I really appreciate it for your time, and enjoy the last few days in Liverpool now that remain for the conference. Really thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
That was quite an episode.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I think it's a very good insights from both Portia and Jeff, and also to see the perspective from business.
Well, exactly. And I think having such a good mix really shows the opportunity when all these guys really come together and can work together to, make London fun again. I mean, it's a bit of a misnomer. We know London is a great city, and it's somewhere that we both live in and we both enjoy. And my family came and made London their home. But I think it's certainly food for thought.
Exactly. And I think it's more about we need to remind ourselves and everyone how great London is, because sometimes we forget, and that's what came through this conversation. And I think for us as Consilio, it's maybe for things to come, these panel discussions for better places.
I think
how exciting they can be.
Yeah, I think having that broad spectrum of people, and also us two morphing into one another, I think is a great thing. One thing I should say, though, is we need to thank guys here at Liverpool Podcast Studios, because they've bared with us with such an intense panel, but the studio's quite nice as well.
Exactly, and lots of requests, and yeah, really appreciate the help, and hopefully we can use them again.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.